chapter of Genesis. But chapter divisions weren't added into the Bible until many centuries after after it was written. And in some places they divided them in very funny places, and this is one of those occasions. So let me finish reading the story. Chapter 2, verse 1. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array, but the seventh day God finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day he rested from all his work. God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. This chapter and few verses is indeed very seminal to Western thinking and to Judaic thinking and to Christian thinking. It's a bit like an embryo. And you get it? You can see all kinds of things that it might be able to grow up to. If you've actually seen what it develops by looking at the rest of Western history or the rest of the Bible, you can start to see all kinds of things in the embryonic shape here in this chapter. There's a whole manner of things which are here, which I guess you wouldn't see in a first reading through, but given the rest of the scriptures, you can actually see. It's my intention that we try and keep to some extent to this chapter itself, rather than going into the way in which the Bible uses it, although undoubtedly I have been influenced by that and can't help it, and on occasions I will just make passing reference to where you might like to think further in terms of what the Bible will make of this opening chapter. The starting point for most inquiries of people these days is themselves, seeing that's one fixed point that they want to agree upon. That is, that they're around and that they're someone or they're something, and I start to try and work out questions like, who am I, what am I, where am I coming from, where am I going to, what am I doing when I'm here, why am I here, what on earth is the point of my living? Psalm 8 takes up that kind of idea, what is man that God's mindful of him? And it raises the question of my own self and my own prominence and importance. That, of course, might be a very misleading question, because it might, by its very definition, give to myself more importance than I am worthy of. And the importance and significance of man is a great area of problem for modern 20th century thinker. That is, as we've got to know of the vast expanse of the universe, we cannot help but see ourselves as but a speck. As we get to know of the vast expanse of time, of the existence of this universe, we again can't help but think of ourselves as a tiny speck which is an appendix at the end. And we wonder, well, what are we really? Are we just a speck? Are we just a little bit of dust that is really nothing? That's a really an unfortunate view of oneself, because you can't help but think you're more than just a little bit of a dust of speck. But I've got feelings, and I understand truth, and I can actually understand something of the expanse of the universe. And the other dust, the other bits of dust in the world, they don't understand what I can understand. And I'm a person, and I want to be treated with rights. And therefore I want to see that as a man I am more than just that, but I don't know on what grounds I am more than just that. If I go back into my history to try and understand myself, as is the current trend, we've got roots, and roots repeated, and roots again, and I go back to my roots to find out who am I, and what am I, and where have I come from, I try and define myself in terms of my history, my family name, my heritage. Why is it that I, an Anglo-Saxon speaker with a Danish name, could be speaking to a group of people in Australia on the towards the end of the 20th century? How can it be that I am here? How did I get here? Where have I come to get here? And why on earth am I here? Which you may like to wonder too. But I don't really find many answers in that kind of inquiry as to where I am, as to who I am, from where I've come from, although most of the world's thinkers have spent some time investigating it and giving some kind of idea of the origins of mankind or of the universe in the hope that we will gain some meaning into our own selves. The Bible would encourage us to do that to some extent. Indeed, that's where it starts off, at the beginning of the Bible. The first chapter is all about the origins. The word Genesis means. But the rest of the Bible gives us a warning which I think we need to heed before we look at this chapter. That is, that we are people with limited perception. Now, we know that, true enough, don't we? I mean, you all know the story of dog whistles, I presume. I've never actually seen a dog whistle, but I understand the principle of dog whistles, that when you blow them, because of the frequency, the human ear cannot hear the noise. But the dog, whose sensory receptors are different to humans, can hear the noise and will respond. That should tell me something about myself, shouldn't it? tells me that my sensory receptors do not take in all the information that is available. I am limited. Can't help when I use I in terms of mankind, but you might like to say, yes, you are, very. Likewise, you get it with a pair of sunglasses I've got, which I can't understand, and those of you around can explain it to me later, or at least explain it to each other, you won't be able to explain it to me. But my sunglasses show that all kinds of windscreens of cars have got wriggly lines all over them. It's got to do with a hardening process on the glass, I understand, and what gets filtered out and filtered in and through my glasses, etc. And I can see which cars have got it and which cars haven't got it, but I don't know what it is they've got, and I don't understand how I can see it. But I know I can see it when I've got the glasses on, and I know I can't see it when I've got them off. Right? That tells you something about my sensory perceptions, doesn't it? It says that I do not take in all the information unaided. I actually need help to perceive the world as it is. Now, the Bible says that that is true on the subject of God. That what is true about God is quite unmistakable, but our perception of it is often mistaken. And it's mistaken because we do not want to know the truth. It's more like than the ability of people on being told that they're dying of cancer not to hear that they've heard it. So that the doctor goes and says, well, you know, there's no doubt about it, that the cancer's malignant. There's no way it can be operated upon. We can give you some radiotherapy, but it really won't make much difference, and chemotherapy, and that's not going to make much difference. You know, in the short time, you will die. And the person says, thank you very much for telling me. I'm so glad it's not malignant, and I've got the opportunity of getting better. They cannot take in that piece of information. They will not take in that piece of information. And there's a whole studies you can do on people's ability to screen out information they do not like because it is so offensive to them as persons that it is unbearable taking it. Now, the subject of God is a little like that, says the Bible, that it is so unbearable to think of its implications that we tend to avoid believing it, even though we've been told quite plainly. Now, I need to put that warning in at the beginning of looking at the Genesis story, because when we come to read of the God who created the world in these terms, it has far-reaching implications about us, about who I am, what I am, why I'm here, what I'm doing. But they're implications which I may not like, and therefore will not take in the information honestly and fairly. But I would commend to you that the normal alternative we go for is that we find an alternative to God, and the alternative we find is always worse than the one that is revealed in the Bible. And I hope by the end of this study, and it's a good question whether I'll finish this one, I hope by this end of this study to show you that everybody has views, the view of this subject, and most people have an alternative view, and the alternatives, while they sound attractive at the beginning, are actually horrific. They are much, much worse than the thing that you're given here. Let's look firstly then at the chapter of Genesis, and I've put it under two headings you'll see in the outline. Firstly is the structure of Genesis, and secondly the leading theses within the chapter. The structure of Genesis 1 is very noticeable. Verse 1 talks about the beginning and the creation of all things. I take it that the translation "in the beginning" is the correct one. There is some variations you'll find in the New English Bible. And it can be viewed, verse 1, in one of two ways. Either it's a summary of the whole lot, so that he tells you that God created everything, and then he tells you how he created everything. Or alternatively, and I take the alternative myself, although I'm not going to go to the stake for it, he's saying that God creates the whole lot first up, and then, subsequently, he separates it out. He teases it out into the form in which you've got. And so the 6 days or the 7 days that follow are God teasing out the creation of matter, which he started with in verse 1. So the process is one of creation of everything in verse 1, and then the teasing out of that through the rest of the chapter, with two possible exceptions, namely the creation of life and the creation of personality, which you come to in verses 21 and 27, but more of that in a few moments. The chapter then proceeds with a set format. It's an interesting chapter, isn't it? Once read, never forgotten, this chapter. Now, why is it like that? You might forget some of the details, but the general structure of the chapter is so patently clear, isn't it? Because there's a repetition throughout it. It's almost like a poem that has got certain stock phrases. I've written them down there under two. God said, let there be. And then you fill in whatever is the appropriate thing. And there was whatever it was he said to let be. And God saw that. And he saw that it was good. And God called it by its name. And there was evening and there was morning, whatever the day might be in which it occurred. There is this set formula that is repeated throughout the chapter, which lies as the very structure of the chapter, which means that once you've read it, you've got the drift of it. You don't forget it either. Each of those parts of the formula, though, are important. It really is an incredible piece of literature in its simplicity and its ease of structure. But the structure itself seems to me to be reflecting the character of the content. That is, the content has given rise to this form. Because the content is saying, and the chapter is saying, that God has structured a world. And he says that God has structured a world in a structured fashion, so that you'll get the message one way or the other. The form actually reinforces the content. God says, demonstrates that God creates by his word. My father worked in the Department of Main Roads. My father-in-law worked in the Department of Main Roads for many years and is retired now. And we've always joked with him about the fact that he paints the line down the centre and that he painted the Harbour Bridge and collected the tolls and all the rest of it, some of which he did. But all of which he did, in fact, because being a man who had risen through the ranks of the Department of Main Roads, he sent people out to paint the lines. He said, you go paint the line on such and such a road between the 3rd mile and the 4th mile. And the lines were painted because he said it. So in a sense, he did paint them. But he did it by word rather than by paintbrush. And he could do it by word because he had authority, because he had the power, whether he liked it or not, to have it done just at his word. Now, such is the power of God that he but speaks and it takes place. Now, how his word is turned into action, the chapter doesn't bother to go into, because what it's trying to highlight is the fact that God has done it, and he has done a lot of it, and he's done it by mere speech, by just saying the word. And the creation is obedient. When he says, let there be light, there was light. It comes into being in direct response and obedience to his command. God looks at it on each occasion when he creates, and he sees that it is good. That is, that it fulfills his purpose. See, what is the meaning of the word good right back at the beginnings in the creation of the world? What does good mean? It means it fulfills God's purpose. It satisfies his intention. He is satisfied with it, the way it is. And so it actually injects into the world a concept of purposiveness. That is, God's purposiveness. God then calls it. And the calling and the naming of everything is important, again, to demonstrate the lordship of God over things. He who names something else or someone else is the conqueror, is the ruler. You didn't choose your own name until you reached an age when you could reject your parents' name and then choose your own name. Whoever is in control is the one who does the naming. When Australia is finally conquered by another nation, then all the names of the cities and the suburbs will be changed to fit in with that other nation. Botany Bay was only known as Botany Bay once the English arrived. It wasn't known as that before that. And it's the power of the English that they can give a place its name and have all over the world until they've been changed bit by bit back to other names, because other countries have conquered the British Empire, Commonwealth, Disillusion, or whatever you want to call it. God's naming of things is his indication of his lordship. And then on each concluding section, you get the phrase, there was evening and there was morning, because of the Jewish way of counting the day from late evening rather than from the break of day. There was evening and there's morning, such and such a day. And so you see there's an orderly progression in God's work. That he is actually step by step, stage by stage, unfolding and teasing out his creation into the state in which he wants it. Now Isaiah chapter 45 verse 18 rightly picks up the idea of God's creation as being habitation. That God moves from chaos to habitation. And throughout this chapter, you see there is an increasing order of detail, an increasing movement away from chaotic existence, like formless and empty in verse 1, up to the very highly sophisticated creation of man in the end. Piece by piece is put into its place so that man can live in this world with his food, with his charter to do what he needs to do. In fact, you can see that the first 3 days create the context in which the second 3 days tend to live. That is, light and dark is created, then the earth is created. The waters are created, then the earth is created. They're the context in which things exist. And then you get the created of the things that exist in those contexts, such as the birds and the fish, the animals, the vegetation, rather the animals, and finally, of course, man. And there's an increasing, the ascending order of creation, with man the climax. Man the climax can be seen in the fact that he alone, of all creation, is created in the image of God. And there's actually a pause in the structure, a little kind of a pause in the music with a bit of a roll of the drums to give you warning that we are now reaching the high point. For the whole thing changes its structure when God says, let us make man. He actually deliberates about this one. The others he just said, let there be. But now he stops and deliberates and says, let us make man. And he makes man in our own image. And so God created man in his image. So man comes as the final creation of God, the high point of it, the one for whom other parts of creation have been existed, and the only part of it that is created like God in his image, which we'll explain in due course, I trust. Throughout the chapter, you see a change in style taking place, which reinforces this view. There is the use of the Hebrew word bara, which is only ever used of God as the subject, which means created. That is, it would seem, because the usage is so rare, it's hard to prove it, but I think it is right, that it's actually the meaning of the word to make something from nothing. See, that's not a word you use very often, is there? I mean, because not many of us do that, do we? Right? That out of nothing, most of us make nothing. In fact, we're hard-pressed to find nothing these days. But if you do find it, you'll find it even harder to make anything out of it, won't you? So it's not the kind of word that you want to use every day of the week. And it's only ever used of God in the Old Testament. And it's used three times in this chapter. In chapter 1, verse 1, when God creates everything. In chapter 1, verse 21, when you get the creation of life, other than vegetable life. And in chapter 1, verse 27, when you get the creation of man. And you wonder whether he's not trying to make the point that at these three special places, that God's creative work is at its height. The wording, let us make, also clearly indicates a change that is taking place, but it's an interesting one, isn't it, that the God who is so clearly monotheistic and who has not, it would seem at this stage, created any other beings with whom to create, now should consider and discuss it in terms of let us make, which Christians in their Trinitarianism have always seen it as an indication of God's plurality, God's singular plurality. That's the headache, isn't it? But which need not be that. It could be just the royal plural or something like that, and you'll find Jewish commentators will follow that kind of view. The Sabbath denouement, the ending up of the chapter, the whole section in chapter 2, verses 1 to 3, is also a strange anticlimax. You've reached the pinnacle, and you, like the editor, want to chop at the end of chapter 1 and say, well, that's it. But something else happens. There is a seventh day, and this seventh day is God's own special day that he sets aside for himself, and more of that in a few moments. Well, then, there's the structure of Genesis 1. The ascending, orderly progression from chaos, from nothing to chaos, from chaos to habitation, the habitation of man under the sovereignty of God. Now, there are leading themes that come out of Genesis 1, leading theses, and they revolve around three subjects in particular. One, God; two, the creation; and three, man. God is the centre of this chapter. 34 verses I've listed out there, because I go through to chapter 2, verse 3. 34 verses, I think, and 35 times God is mentioned. It's all about God. The whole chapter is about God and his work of creation. He is the creator, we are told, of everything. That is the first fundamental thing you find out about God in the Bible. He created, and he created everything. The heavens, the earth, the stars, the sun, the light, the darkness, whatever it is, he has created it, and he has created it all in detail. Every part of it, down to each of its own kinds, etc. And he creates it with great ease. He just speaks, and it comes into being. It's all, though, under him. Second thing we see about God is that his creation is a creation from nothing to everything. There is nothing outside his creation. He has actually started from scratch and takes it all up to its end point. Tolkien, who some of you read, in his lifetime always rejected being called a creative writer. He disliked the term creative because he believed there was only one creator, and that was God. All he was ever doing was remodeling. He was never actually creating from nothing. And he had a good point in making the point too. because God alone is actually working from nothing to something. Third thing about God is that he creates for purpose. He actually casts moral judgment upon it. He says, this is good. They're very important, you see, because it actually injects then into the world the concept of purposiveness. That this creation has fulfilled his intention. Now, it also gives us the base of purposiveness, too. That is God. Some 5 years ago, was sat in on a Philosophy 1 lecture class here, and the lecturer, quite rightly, made 2 points. And in my discussion with people afterwards, they all rejoiced in the first and screened out the second. Very interesting in the tutorial group I shared with later, that they hadn't picked up the second at all, but they'd all taken in the first. Let's see if you do any better. He said, if you want to do away with sin, dispense with God. That one they all got. That's a ripper thing, see? If you don't have God, you don't have sin. You don't have guilt, you don't have judgment. It's marvellous. You want to get rid of guilt, sin? Get rid of God. The second one, if you don't have a God, if you don't have God making the world, he was saying rather, then you don't have any concept of the purpose of life. And for people to come and say, what is the purpose of living, is a nonsense question if there is no God who has made the world. That one didn't get in. Didn't sink through. Because while it's very convenient, you see, to get rid of the idea of sin, it's not so convenient to get rid of the idea of purpose and meaning and value. To live a life that is purposeless, meaningless, and valueless is fairly hard to come by. And so most people didn't even actually take in the point that he'd made, although he made it at greater length and with more vigour than the first one, which was just a castaway line and very humorous, but sunk in. More of it in a few moments and you'll see the point. God's creation is creation with purpose, and finally God creates by his word. That is, the world is not an extension of God. The world isn't God. This is not God, like a pantheist would believe this is God. God is something other than the world. He's over beyond the world, and he creates it by speech. The world is not a mindless divine activity. It's not that one day God fell asleep, and as he snored, the world tumbled out of his nostrils. It's not like that. You might think it's a preposterous idea. You read the Babylonian creation myth, it's almost like that. It's not like it's a purposeful intention of God. He actually expressed what he wanted to do. He wanted to make this particular universal system as he has it. So it's not a divine slip like that. It's a purposeful creation of the mighty God who by his word has created the world. You may now think into your Christian categories, if you like, that Jesus in the beginning of John's Gospel, for example, is described as the word of God by whom the world was created and for whom the world was created. You might also like to think of it in terms of Colossians chapter 1 also. The second thing you say about is creation. Creation, then, we're taught in this chapter, is contingent. That is, dependent. You don't like the word contingent. It's dependent. It is dependent upon God. It is not an independent existence. It has not always existed independent of God and does not exist independent of God, but actually depends and relies upon him. It came into being because he brought it into being. Not because it decided one sunny morning to come into being. That's not the way it is. Everything in creation is actually dependent upon God, according to this chapter. Furthermore, the creation that we are in is not a chaotic one, but a habitable one. One that has been created for man to inhabit, and therefore is orderly and planned to be orderly. And we should expect to see orderliness in it. Again, you see, the implications of it are very far-reaching. It's not until mankind came to accept that view that they ever bothered on the scientific inquiry. Because if you don't believe the world is orderly, there's no point examining it for its orderliness, is there? There's no point running an experiment today and expecting the same result tomorrow. If you think it's all chaotic, then of course you'd never bother running experiments from one day to another or recording the events of what's taking place. Orderliness was a very important point to understand before modern science could rise, and that is why out of Western society it did rise, because Western society was so heavily influenced by Genesis chapter 1, I would suggest. Might like to inquire into Butterfield's writings on the history of science to see the importance of Christian thinking and Genesis thinking to come to understand orderliness, to come to see the possibility of being looking for order and meaning in the world. Also, the creation is something which fulfills God's desire. That is, the physical world fulfills God's desire. This is a very important point, because most people want to think that the physical is not what Christians are about. They're only about the spiritual. But the Bible actually starts right off saying the world, the physical world, is good, very good. God's blessing on the animals is what? Sex. That's his blessing. That's the great blessing he gives to them. He blesses them and says, be fruitful and multiply. I presume that's got to do with sex, at least my biology listens. That's what I understood anyway. Right? That is the blessing he gives to men and women too. That God creates sex, and he sees sex as being a great blessing for us. He's actually pro the physical pleasures of the world, because he has created the physical pleasures of the world and created them for our enjoyment. It actually says something very important, that the creation itself is good, not evil. Again, you can think out the implications that will flow on from that in terms of monasticism and asceticism and the like. Man then, finally, in the third theme of the Bible, this chapter would seem to me to be pointing to, man then, we can see as someone who has been created, and therefore, like the rest of creation, is contingent upon God, is dependent upon God. He is not self-existent. He shares with the rest of creation that dependency upon God. And secondly, but man is unique in creation, for he alone is created in the image of God. He has a relationship with God that nothing else bears. Now, people have tried to find what this image of God means in terms of man, and they said, well, man's more intelligent than the rest of creation, therefore it's intelligence which shows. Now, that's not actually what the Bible is saying at all, and of course that means that the more intelligent you are, the more godly you are, and so we must be at the pinnacle sitting here at the university. Which, of course, is absolute rubbish, and we can reject that idea fairly quickly and easily. It's not got to do with that. Right? It's got to do with the fact that we bear a relationship with God. Now, what is that relationship? Well, it seems to me that the passage itself most naturally would be understood in terms of our lordship over creation. That when God creates man in his image, he places man as the lord of creation, the underlord, if you like, because we're still under him, we're still contingent upon him. But we are given the rule of the universe. God is the ruler of all, and he places one part of his creation over the rest of creation. That is man. And that is his image that we bear. Now remember that that bearing of the image, that lordship, should be reflected in the way in which we care for it and look after it and tend it as he does, rather than in the way we rip it off. You'll get the rip-off after chapter 3. But in chapter 1, the lordship is still like God, caring for and tending. But that has got to do with our being unique in creation. Now, I put down the problem of sin. You don't find it in chapter 1, but everything I've said so far screams of it, because most of what I'm saying doesn't fit. See? The world is not orderly like we'd like it to be. Oh, it is sometimes. But Mount Etna, is that orderly? San Francisco, is an earthquake this morning. I mean, you might like to find orderly processes that involve, which can explain the dynamics of the earth and so on, but I'd suggest to you that we keep on finding man not in control. We're using up the resources of petrol. We're turning to uranium and we're scared stiff because we don't think we can control it, or is it we can't control ourselves, or both. We're not so much in control as overlords or underlords under the God. We're not really very good at it. And so we're semi-terrified of it. Now, the Bible explains that, but that comes after chapter 3 of Genesis. You've got to hang on a couple of weeks to get the whole picture. It's very important at that point. But yet what it is saying is true, isn't it? That in all the creation, who does run the show but men? That is true. And that the world has got an orderliness about it is true. And that we are unique in the world like that is true. But that we are not self-existent eternal beings seems fairly evident too by our insistence on taking up the best real estate for cemeteries. Now then, when you come to see what he said in Genesis 1, you haven't seen anything till you realise what he hasn't said in Genesis 1. And you've got to see the antithesis of what is being said to realise how enormous are the statements in this chapter. Now whether he is conscious of these antitheses or not, I do not know. Because we don't know who wrote this chapter when. There's your problem. If you knew who wrote it and when he wrote it, under what conditions he wrote it, then you would know who he's having a shot at. But as you don't know who wrote it and when he wrote it, you don't know who he's having a shot at. But when you read other viewpoints of the world, you can say, yes, he is having a shot at them, provided you don't mean by that, and I know that he had them in mind when he was writing it. He may or may not have had them in mind when he was writing it. As a believer in the inspiration of scriptures, I'm sure God had it in mind when he was writing it. But what the bloke who wrote it had in mind, at this point, I cannot be sure. For example, in Western Mesopotamian texts, we find, such as Babylonian texts, we find that the seventh day is always seen as an evil day. It's a wicked day, so they're very heavily dominated by astrological thinking, and seven was an evil number. The seventh day was the most evil of all days that could exist, and the seventh time, seventh day, was a shocker of all times. You didn't go outside the door. Like our Friday the 13th. Right? It was just, only they believed it much more rigorously than we tend to believe it. We just make a joke about it, but, or do we? But they actually did believe the seventh day was a terribly wicked, inauspicious occasion to do anything. Now, is the author actually trying to say something when he makes the seventh day God's day? Is that what he's actually trying to say? Is he trying to say, we don't think numerically in symbols, do we? When we talk about numbers, seven, we think somewhere between 6 and 8, square root of 49. That's all we can kind of think of, that kind of deal, a prime number, isn't it? But they think much more symbolically, the ancient world, in its usage of numbers. And the number seven, the great sign of wickedness and evil, they say, oh no, the God who created all the world, he's created it. Number seven, that's his special day. Is that what he's trying to say? Well, you don't know when he wrote it. You don't know whether he wrote it before that Mesopotamian myths and ideas or after. So you don't know if he had it in mind or not. Certainly it was used. Well then, what are the alternatives? What are the antitheses that you can say? I've listed out A to I there. I've put definitions on the back which are not really definitions at all. They are useful definitions for today's study and only today's study. All right? That is, off the top of my head, that's how I use the words. If you look up the dictionary, they might be used differently, but that's, I didn't write the dictionary. That's how I'm using the words, all right? And I'm saying they're alternatives that I can understand as being meaningful alternatives to the view of the Bible. And most of these alternatives are available today. You can read them in the newspapers, most of them. They're still around about. And people often don't realise that they are taking up one of these alternatives. They think they can dispense with Genesis 1 and go back to nothing. You don't go back to nothing, you go to an alternative. And here are some of them. That there's always been an eternal force, good and bad. And they're at war with each other and you don't know which one's going to win because they're almost equal. A whole polytheism where there's lots and lots of gods and there's marvellous myths. The Babylonian myths are classic in it. Where the creation of the world actually is not a creation at all. It's the gods all fighting up with each other and in the end one of them conquers the other and splits her right down the middle and sticks one side her over there, that's the sky, and the other side, that's the earth. And all kinds of incredible myths that when you read you think that's staggering. I mean, but they are the common things that were held at the time in which this was written, roughly. And this in its stark simplicity, in its striking monotheism, in its lack of myth and mythology, cannot help but be seen as a polemic against that polytheistic mythology and terror that strikes, and horror that strikes, and immorality that strikes in people's hearts. Or astrology. See? The stars and the moon and the sun and all this sort of have influence over our lives. They actually run the world and run mankind because of their movements and their patterns. They actually structure it. It's commonly believed 80% of Australians read their stars columns every day. 28% of Australians act upon them, so the Gallup poll says. It's commonly believed today that the things of this world are actually in control. The things of the universe are in control. Whereas what God says in verse 14 and following of chapter 1 of Genesis is that those things have been stuck up there as time signals for you. I mean, we don't have electric clocks in the first few centuries of this of human experience. And so what God's done, he's done something better for you. He's stuck a clock up in the sky for you. And all it's there for is so as to tell you when the daytime's on and when the nighttime's on. That's putting the stars in their place, so to speak. They are put in their place so as to be put in their place, so that man won't be worshipping the stars, but we'll see the stars as just part of God's handiwork. A friend of mine who does read the stars brought this in to me the other day from Bridget's Amazing Thing People Ask in Starline. I don't know which newspaper it comes from. Sometimes, she writes, people are faced with enormous problems that even astrology does not have the answer for. They have to face up to them and think the answers out for themselves. That was a staggering comment, that one. And you see, there is that whole view of conducting my life by the movements of the stars, because I believe the stars are things. Now I suggest to you, when you move to alternatives, whatever alternatives there are, you will actually move mankind into a lesser position. You will move yourself into a lesser position than you ever get in Genesis chapter 1. Let me illustrate it from two, and that is materialism and mysticism, and then show you how its implications to the place of man. I most likely won't get through them both. I'll pick on materialism. I'll pick these two because they are the most common, and you'll find that the average Australian believes both of them, although they are completely opposites. See, materialism is the view that there is matter which is eternal, and that's all there is. There is only matter. You can call it matter particles of any kind you want to, energy or whatever it might be, but it's always been, and there's only matter, and there's nothing other than matter. That being the case, you and I are matter. That is all we are. We're matter that has actually extrapolated itself out into the particular format that we're in. Two arms, two legs, hair, the colour, the eyes, etc. But we are just matter extrapolated out over time for centuries and centuries and centuries until this is us. But I am fundamentally no different to this, or this, or anything else either. I mean, I'm not fundamentally different. I've just actually evolved into this pattern, whereas this has evolved into a pattern which I've been able, my predecessors have worked over into another kind of pattern, but it's wood, I'm flesh. Matters matter. It's all the same, and in a sense, it doesn't matter. Now, I then have the problem of asking the question, who am I? But as soon as I ask that question, it indicates that I'm not really a materialist yet, because a materialist can't ask the question, who am I? Because who is a personality? What I should be asking is, what am I? Not who am I? Because I am not a who, I'm only a what. There are no such things as whos. In fact, when I say what am, or who am I, it shows that my matter is not actually twitching in the right fashion. It's disoriented. It actually thinks it's something it's not. It thinks it's a person. And in those things as persons, there's only matter. That's all there is. And all my thoughts, they're just the twitchings of my grey matter. And if my thoughts are wrong, well then my twitchings are inadequate. That's all. And so in a sense, this is better off than I am because it doesn't twitch the wrong way. Because I'm only matter. I know it's being fairly sarcastic and pushing the point fairly hard, but that's because most people won't push it fairly hard. They won't see that if all there is matter, and that's all there has ever been, then life is utterly pointless. We're here because we're here because we're here because we're here. That is all there is to it. I didn't ask to come into the world. I won't ask to leave the world. And I can ask all I like, but there's nobody to ask because there's only things here. There's only things. And I am part of the only things. Life is completely and utterly meaningless and pointless. Now, you can find that. You can find that in writings of the existentialists, can't you? Existentialist literature, they take it seriously. There is no God, or as they would put it, rather, God is dead. Therefore, and you get Dostoevsky, and you get Kafka, and you get all that hideous kind of literature, which is a world which is unlivable in. And it really makes nonsense of my own experience. Because what it says is there's no justice, there's no love, there's no truth. There are no higher principles, there is no meaning, there is no purpose. There is just matter. And so, we must live amorality. There's no such thing as morality. There are no values. Do what you like. If rape turns you on, turn yourself on. Because all you've got are your senses. And if certain senses are pleased one way and they're not pleased another way, well, you may as well do them the pleasing way as the non-pleasing way. It's a matter of complete indifference. And so, acquisitive self-centeredness, that is the style of the materialist. I don't know whether you've ever contemplated it much, but it would seem to me that is exactly what Western society is about, isn't it? The fact that millions of people in the world are starving, well, that's tough. I mean, they didn't have the brains to be born in Australia, did they? That's their hard lookout. Stiff cheddar. I've got enough food for myself. They can go down the hole as far as I'm concerned. It really doesn't matter. Provided I can acquire enough of a standard of living to keep my senses at their absolute peak, that is all right. That is the end result of that. And that is an abhorrent thing for anyone who's got the slightest concept of ideals. But it also brings you into terrible idolatry, doesn't it? A terrible worshipping. You live your life for your possessions. That's what materialism is all about, isn't it? Materialism is materialism. It's the belief that there's only matter. And therefore, all you do is grab for matter. And you live your life for the things you can gain. The bank account that you can acquire. That's all there is. Materialism is its own self-defeating bondage. Now, on the other hand, you can move to mysticism, which says that matter is a load of rubbish. That all that counts is the spirit that's been dropped into the matter. But the matter is sinful, is immoral, is in some sense bad. Now, there's all kinds of manners of mysticism. I've kept it very vague so as to try and show you the general trend of all of them, from Plato to the monastics, from Christian Science to the Hare Krishnas. They've all got the same drift. That is, that the physical world is evil in one sense, or is unreal. And the real world is the spiritual world. And what I've got to do is conquer the physical by meditation, by yoga, whatever it might be. I free my spirit from the physical realm. And of course, it also leads me into a terrible pointlessness, really. I again can't ask who I am, because when I actually get out of this physical realm, the great thing that happens is I lose my individuality and I get caught back up into the world soul, where we're all one. And this great love and unity that comes out of mysticism actually comes out of the fact that I don't exist as a person. That is also an error of my physical body. But I, as a soul, am just part of soul. And as I get back up into soul, so I disappear as a person. I am not a who. And of course, the physical world, there's no point to worry about it. And it's interesting, it runs into one of two directions. Either complete asceticism, where every physical pleasure is evil, like the Hare Krishnas, who I understand only have sex in order to have babies, and if they enjoy it, even on that occasion, they're sinning, they're failing, because they're showing that their physical matter is controlling their spirits. The whole thing is evil. That is why they dress in the drab way they do, so as to avoid any physical pleasure at all, either by sight, because it's all wrong. Or on the other hand, you say, well, the physical doesn't matter, so I may as well go for the broke and get every bit I can, because it really doesn't matter. Either come out of mysticism, either lead men into terrible bondages. Whereas, here, you see man with his distinctiveness. You see man not losing his distinctiveness. He is different to the animals. He is in the image of God. Killing whales is not murder. It's wrong. I don't like it. I think it's a stupid way of carrying on business and all the rest of it. But it's not murder, because a whale is not a human. And I'm not going to call a whale a human. A whale is not created in the image of God. Never has been created in the image of God. And humans have got rights that whales haven't got. But that confusion of the animal world with the human world, which reaches its climax in that philosophy professor in Melbourne University who's put out a book against any form of killing anything other than anything, really, and I wonder how he eats anymore, because it's very hard to eat without killing something, because he makes no distinction whatsoever. And he says speciesism is the last wickedness of man that he's working on. That distinctiveness is lost when you turn away from God. The responsibility is lost when you turn away from God, because you're not treated as a person in the image of God, held responsible for creation. But like B.F. Skinner, how does he treat you? He says we must go beyond freedom. We must go beyond responsibility. You move to materialism, you move to mysticism, you move to any other form than the God of this Bible, man as man no longer responsible. They are no longer distinctive. You've changed the very nature of who you are and what you are. And for centuries we've been living on the byproduct of Genesis chapter 1 without knowing we've been living on it. And we keep on wanting to pull the plug on that and keep the bathwater in. You can't do it. You want to pull out God and the Creator? Then you pull the plug on yourself at the same time. You are no longer yourself, but will live in fear and bondage. Well, it was a great race through. I'll be around for a while longer if you want to come and quiz. You see that it actually only just starts off a whole range of issues from Genesis 1. But in chapter 2, which we look at next week here, you will actually see the whole story of man and his creation outlined again. How about we close in prayer? We thank you, Father, that you are the creator of the universe, and do pray that you would help us to understand yourself and therefore ourselves properly. And we ask it through the one through whom and for whom you created this world, namely Jesus our Lord. Amen.